This podcast is brought to you by Retro Instruments, makers of the Stay Level, Power Strip, and 176 Limiting Amp. Retro Instruments, vintage design for modern recording. Learn more at retroinstruments.com.
Hey, it's Larry Crane. Welcome to the Tape Op Podcast. Indiana may not be the first place that comes to mind when you think of a blossoming psych rock scene, but you'd be mistaken. Formed in Bloomington and now based in Los Angeles, Frankie and the Witchfingers have been cranking out an interesting sounding and diversely influenced series of albums that document their growth as songwriters and a band, as well as their development as recordists. Jeff Stanfield caught up with Josh Menasche, the band's guitarist and primary engineer, to discuss their process and new album, Data Doom. Enjoy.
So tell me a little bit about just, you know, you guys are from Bloomington, Indiana, not a town that, you know, comes up a ton in terms of music hotbeds, but I'm sure that there's a scene there. I think that that's, you know, of course, every town has a scene because people need something to do, right? So,
yeah, there's a huge scene there. I went to college there. I moved there in 2009. And right away, I was going to house shows, seeing this, like, fluid scene of all these different genres playing together. There's just so many good bands there. It's kind of crazy. And now going around talking about these bands, very few people know about them. There's a few that have kind of escaped the Bloomington bubble. Bands like Murder by Death or who else? There was a band, Hoops, a couple years ago. But other than that, it's kind of a very insular scene, which is really cool. You know, I learned a lot from those people and went to countless shows there.
Genre wise, is it all over the place, or is it really kind of focused on this? Like, was there a strong garage psych rock scene?
No, you know, it was kind of all over the place, but the shows that I would go to would just have, you know, real instruments, guitar based music. There's a lot of, you know, the Midwest emo was pretty big in the early 2010s. Saw a lot of that. There was a pretty good garage psych scene. There was a label out of there called Magnetic South that does a lot of, like, two-tape analog recordings. The main guy's actually out in L.A. now. But there was some, you know, there was a good, healthy amount of garage rock bands, I'd say.
And when you and Dylan got together, I mean, did you guys meet in college? I don't really know the story of how you two guys got together.
We met in 2012, I want to say. We can never remember if it was 12 or 13. Who knows? I had already dropped out of college at that point because all I wanted to do was make music. Dylan had just moved to Indiana not to go to college, just to play music and be in a better scene. And, yeah, we met each other, and we both had other bands at the time, but kind of wanted to make more music than those particular bands could, you know, facilitate. So it was nice to, you know, meet up with someone new. It kind of started as a side project, honestly, for both of us.
And your initial recordings were all done by yourself. And I think your first record was released on cassette. Was that all just recorded at your houses or basement kind of stuff?
Yeah, that was recorded in I used to live with our old drummer, Glenn, and he kind of engineered those first couple records. The first one was like as raw as it gets. Some of the songs were just a condenser mic in a room and drums and guitar, and then we'd maybe overdub a bass after. But it was a lot of it was like one mic to record the bulk of the music.
And was that what became, was that Sidewalk?
That's Sidewalk, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty lo-fi, but it definitely has like a, I mean, you guys managed to you know, make it sound like something. I mean, it's pretty mushy, but
yeah, it's super mushy. It's slamming the, it was a Tascam 488, one of those 8-track tape machines. So it's slamming it pretty hard. So yeah, only fitting that it got released on cassette, you know.
You know what I thought was fun, you know, just this morning, kind of just going through the progression of albums that you guys had recorded. And it's a very fun process because you kind of see the progression of the sonics improve. You sort of get to see the learnings of the band, the progression of the songwriting, especially on these later records. When you guys, I guess both of you moved to LA, is that right?
Yeah.
And you have new band members. You really get to see, you know, the story told through the music is pretty interesting. Sort of a sonic journey and its own biography in a way, you know.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool to hear. I definitely have learned how to record and mix with the band, so it's I would hope that it gets slightly better each time, fidelity wise.
I wanted to definitely talk about Data Doom at some point and maybe get into a few of the songs on that record more specifically. But can you talk to me about some of these earlier recordings? I mean, you just said that Sidewalk was recorded essentially like one mic with very few overdubs. You know, what about something like Brain Telephone? I guess that was recorded to a 388.
Yeah.
So you guys made a step up.
Oh yeah, we had just gotten that tape machine, so we're still kind of working out the kinks, but that was a big step up fidelity wise. Although we were still learning to use it. And I don't know if you or the listeners know, but there's a function called like DBX, noise reduction, where it depends if you turn it on or off. If you record with it on, it'll eliminate that like noise floor and kind of compress things. But we had forgotten to do that and sometimes, and there's like 3 or 4 bass tracks I recorded on it with the wrong setting on, and we just left it. So it still got a lot of, you know, weird artifacts going on.
That record is kind of crazy to me because it sounds like, I mean, there's parts of it that literally sound like a Sam and Dave record. You know, it's like a soul record in a lot of ways. It's and it seems like you guys have done that a little bit kind of throughout. Like there seems to be more, you know, it still sounds like your band, but there are the influences of certain genres kind of sneak in a little bit more prevalently. What's the thought process going into making a record like that?
You know, back then it wasn't really when we would go into making an album, it wasn't a conscious effort. It was kind of a collection of songs at that point. So I would say the influence just snuck in. You know, we listened to a lot of soul music. Dylan's from Kentucky. His favorite art, like one of his favorite artists is the Everly Brothers. So that's probably a big influence, like harmonically. I think that record started to feature a lot more vocal harmonies. But yeah, soul, doo-wop, all that stuff's a huge influence. Maybe it just seeped in more back then.
And when you guys are going into the studio, like what's the setup? I mean, I'm sure it's evolved over time, of course, and no record is the same necessarily. But will you talk about like some of those early records, what the setup was for the drums, what mics you were using, what gear you guys had? I mean, it sounds like it wasn't recorded at Ocean Way, so, you know.
No, not at all. The first 3 records were recorded in a bedroom in Bloomington, Indiana. The drum setup was overhead condenser mic. I think it was in some kind of Audio Technica. And then a 58 or 57 on the kick. And we would try to do either bass and drums live or guitar and drums live, just to get it as live as possible. And then, you know, overdub from there. The bass was always direct in. I think it was Brain Telephone was the first album we recorded in like somewhat of a treated space, which was just our practice space at the time. It was nice though, because it had a control room. and, you know, stuff feeding through it, a snake feeding through it. So that was nice to have that. We would record the bulk of the instruments there and then take it home to do overdubs, experiment. So yeah, up until that point, it was all very like home recorded.
And then at what point was it ZAM where you guys was the big step up to a more kind of what, you know, quote, air quotes, pro recording?
Yeah, kind of. That one was recorded in a basement studio at a friend of ours' house, the band Twin Temple. They had an awesome Silver Lake house, which they don't own anymore, unfortunately. And in the basement was a total treated studio, control room, and we just brought our tape machine in there and had it running through their board. So that was the first album we recorded all four, like guitar, bass, drums, all live. And that was like the first record that could facilitate that, like the first space that could facilitate that. And yeah, I definitely heard a step up fidelity-wise. That was the first record I mixed by myself, which was definitely a learning process. I think a lot of the drums are out of phase now when I listen back, but that's just part of it.
Why did you guys move to LA?
I moved to LA. I'm from San Diego, so I moved to just be a little closer to home and be in kind of a more formidable music scene, something where there were more opportunities around. So I moved a year earlier than Dylan did. So there's a year where the band wasn't really active. Dylan was still playing shows with other musicians over in Bloomington, but yeah, I kind of started the movement and he followed about a year later, slept on my couch.
And then at a certain point, you guys swapped a few members, right?
Yeah. Yeah, starting in 2018, we met up with Shaughnessy Starr, who we were already playing at another band with. And yeah, just as soon as we met him and started jamming with him, we were writing the ZAM album. So it was pretty quick.
Following ZAM, there was you guys, was it Monster Eating People Eating Monster?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that, the process of making that record, because again, it's like it's its own beast altogether as well, you know?
When I think back to that record, we recorded it after a year of nonstop touring. So any time in between tours, we would just record these demos on like literally voice memos on your phone. When we'd listen to those songs while we were touring and kind of think about them, kind of imagine what was, you know, what was missing, what could have been added. And at the end of that year of touring, we parted ways with our bass player. So we were just three of us, and we went into a studio in San Diego. It was actually the first studio I ever recorded in when I was in high school. It's called Earthling Studios. And I had a great experience there and, you know, convinced the guys to bring it down there. And luckily he has tape machines and stuff. Like he has a big, like, Fostex two-inch tape machines, which was really nice. And we recorded, you know, the bulk of the album in 5 days down there. I was on bass, Shaughnessy on drums, Dylan on guitar, all live, and then I would overdub my guitar parts. A lot of overdubs going on there.
I mean, at this point, you guys are pretty tight as a band. You guys know each other and, you know, have a thing, but there's no substitute for, you know, going out and playing and being, having a, not just musical thing connection, but the brain connection and just, you know,
yeah.
Although you maybe want to, you know, not be in the same room because you've been in the same van.
Well, it's really different sides of a coin. You know, every time you're like touring forever, you're just like, man, I just want to get into a studio and record. And then it's kind of the opposite. If you're just working on a record for so long, you're like, man, I really want to go play these songs live. And for me, the more I've done both of those, the more each one kind of informs the other. If, like, you see what songs get people going, that kind of informs your songwriting into, you know, what works in a live setting. You're able to connect those two a little better.
Well, I mean, for Monsters, did you guys go in with a idea of the way you want it to sound? I mean, are you guys trying to like go and approach things like stepping off of the last records that you've made and kind of
on them? Yeah, I'd say for sure. That record, we had somewhat of a concept of blending every song into the next. So, you know, writing each song, we'd leave it open-ended or connect it to another song. And we would practice it as one song, but they were really two completely different ones. And then, you know, just the whole thing kind of flows together. So that was a cool exercise, something we'd never done before.
And in terms of the production on that one,
Full
selection of microphones, like kit mic'd up fully.
Yeah, that was a lot of that was, you know, handed over to the engineer at Earthlink, Mike Camus. He was really easy to work with, kind of went off of our ideas of, you know, certain songs having roomy drums, certain having dead, captured it with a bunch and then stripped away mics in the mixing process.
And did you mix that or did he mix that?
I mixed that one, yeah.
And how are you mixing? Just at home in the box or through console or
ear? Yeah, mostly at home. In the box and on through Ableton with a lot of plugins. Yeah. I mean, not too many. We try to get the sound as good as possible before.
Yeah. I mean, what are you ending up with when you are getting to mix? I mean, how many tracks are you dealing with?
A lot. Probably for each song, like 30 or something, 30 or 40. But that album in particular was a total headache to send tracks, you know, get the tracks for, because every song ran into the next one. So you'd have these like overlap sections and it was hard to, you know, process each song differently and then have it seamlessly blend.
And did you, when you delivered your mixes, I mean, I know this is a crazy question, but do you have your records mastered?
Yeah.
Okay. Some guys are just like, nuff.
Yeah, we definitely master them. Yeah, we work with this guy, Nick Townsend, who lived at Costa Mesa at the time, and we'd always go in and be a part of the mastering process.
So when you delivered those particular mixes for Monsters Eating People Eating Monsters,
yeah,
how was that delivered? Was it all the individual songs and then he married them, or was it just one big massive file?
We did A side as one file and B side as one file, and then he clipped them up at the end. But they were processed individually. Then I had to like join them together, then send it to him, and then he cut them up again. It was kind of crazy.
I mean, for a mastering engineer, I mean, I guess there are some benefits to that in terms of levels and sonics and things like that. But like, if you were talking about kind of processing and mixing each song as in its own world and treating it differently, you know, I mean, every record I've ever mastered, each song is sonically a little bit, you know, it's a little different.
Sure.
You could do, you know, that's the whole process. So that must have been a special project for him.
Yeah. He's a wizard. We were there when he did the majority of it. So I'm trying to remember which way he did it. I think he just made like slight adjustments on each track and he'd make markers on where each one was.
And what are you learning as you've gone? What do you feel like you're kind of improving on every time you mix another record? Like, what are the things that you're kind of focusing on one record to the next, or what have you learned?
I think a big thing I've focused on, I used to be super heavy-handed with things like EQ and compression, and now I just try to get the best sound possible before it hits the box. And a lot of the EQ I do now is like reductive, as opposed to like adding frequencies, just kind of shaping what's already there. Trying to mix solely by ear. It's sometimes you look at these plugins and you're like, oh, this is what a snare drum looks like, and there's just no such thing as that, you know.
Let's talk about Data Doom. So tell me about how you guys approach this one, where you recorded it, how you recorded it.
Yeah, Data Doom we started working on in the very beginning of last year, so 2022. We had just started playing with Nick Aguilar, our new drummer. And this was also the first record we started working on with Nikki Pickle, our bass player. So new lineup. And kind of similar to Zam, it was written in the process of still like learning how to play with each other. Learning to play with Nick, I think in our first jam session ever, we just gave him these riffs, and a lot of those beats he put on those ended up being the final, you know, the final rhythms. So it was a good process there. Recording wise, we recorded this one just at our own practice space. So we work in this practice space in like kind of near downtown, and we're the only band in there, which is super, you know, fortunate that we can just leave all the mics set up. Originally, that was our plan, to just record demos, take it to a studio. And we started really to dig how these demos were sounding, you know, the classic case of demoitis.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just stepped it up a little bit, like a few more mics on the drum set, routed it through our tape machine. It's a, we're back to a 388 at this point, a reel to reel. And recorded it in the first half of 2022. Did most of the tracks are just bass and drums tracked live, and then guitars and vocals and everything else overdubbed.
Yeah, it definitely has a new sonic vibe to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's your mixing or the way you're tracking it, probably a little bit of both. Far less mushy, far less compressed, just has a much more open, big kind of sound to it, you know? Yeah, it was like I said earlier, you really get to see the progression, and they're, it's nice to be able to listen to albums individually, but it's also cool to listen to them sequentially. Are you into recording gear, and are you trying to acquire new things, and you know, what new purchases did you make for this, and why?
So with the decision to record in our studio, we kind of used some of our budget to get better mics. And yeah, we picked up a nice, no, like a decent condenser, large diaphragm condenser. And I think it was like a AT4040. And then also a ribbon mic, a stager ribbon mic. And everything else is just, you know, 57s, 58s, your basic mics.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a big step up for this record was, I think, the combining of mics. And a lot of the guitar tracks, I used a ribbon and a dynamic, and kind of took, you know, mixed the two of those to get the tonal quality, rather than relying on EQ later down the line or something, just blending those to have the tone.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, what, the 57 just has so much bite, and then you've got the,
yeah,
the little bit more smoothness of the ribbon. I mean, I don't know that particular ribbon that you're talking about, but...
Oh, yeah, it's smooth. And, yeah, you know, maybe by itself, you definitely would have to add top end too, but the 57 takes care of that. Then we'd use that same ribbon mic as like a kind of a crotch mic for the drums. So just to kind of get a little bit of everything, kind of glue all the drum elements together. Yeah, for drums, if we're going to get nerdy about it, it was a kick, snare, sometimes snare top, sometimes snare bottom, usually just one overhead. It was all mono overhead, crotch mic, and then a room mic.
Nice. So, what are you using for the overhead?
That AT4040 usually. Yeah, sometimes we would do the ribbon mic as the overhead. So each song's a little different. I think on Empire, it's ribbon mic overhead.
And so much of it also is just who's playing the drums. I mean, it's such a huge thing. I mean, you get, I feel like the challenge for a band like yours is that there's pretty, like, the drums are pretty intense, right? Like, you're bashing a little bit. So that can be a challenge in the recording.
Totally, yeah. Nick plays hard, which is part of why we love him. So rather than being like, no, play quieter, we're recording, I just try to capture it. It's definitely a little more more roomy because of that. You know, close miking a hard hitter isn't, yeah, doesn't work as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was just going to say that, like, you know, you got somewhere, that sound's got to go somewhere. So,
yeah,
you know, having a big, a larger room, I don't know what, how big is the room that you guys are recording in?
It's pretty big. I think it's like 20 by 20 with pretty tall ceilings. And what's cool is the, you know, half of the walls are carpeted and the top half are wood panels. So you get a little, you know, deadness on the floor and a little, like, we stick our room mics up top facing away, so it's a nice reflection off the wood panels. Yeah. It's a good room. And it, the only downside is the bands that practice next to us. We kind of have to strategically record when they're not there.
Yep. And how have you continued to educate yourself with things like room mics and placement and
just fucking around, honestly.
Yeah.
I've just messed around for a long time and found what works and doesn't. Still learning for sure. Things like phase, I've watched like YouTube videos, or every time we work with an engineer, I kind of pick their brain, but a lot of it is just messing around.
It just provides a uniqueness that's unto itself, you know? I mean, that's how you hear it. And I think that's, it could be why your records sound interesting in a way that maybe others don't, you know. I really, really like the genre, particularly because a lot of bands are recording themselves and it's super sort of unpro, you know. And I think that there's a uniqueness that you just don't hear on every record. And that, like, again, we get back to this idea of homogenization of music being like, this is how you record a kick drum. Kind of nonsense, right? I mean, it's just aesthetic and how you hear it and your the presentation. Are your band members totally on board with your
aesthetic? which is cool because I've often been the one to suggest, you know, let's go to a studio for this record, and they usually, Dylan kind of pushes me to be like, dude, let's just do it ourselves. And of course I'm down for that. I know that, you know, it's not gonna sound like a studio recording, or it's not gonna sound super polished, but I'd rather it just sound, you know, we'd all rather it sound like us than sound like freaking whatever, Sunset Sound or some crazy studio.
I mean, and the economics of it today in a music world is, I mean, certainly.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, the economics of financially and just having time is really nice. No one feels stressed to get a part down. You know, if it's the vocals aren't working today, come back and do it tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, do you guys put any sort of scheduling or calendar dates? Like, these are the dates we're recording and we hope to, you know, is there a schedule?
There's a loose schedule. We don't really have deadlines other than our own touring schedule, like, hey, let's try to get this done before we go on the road for 2 months. So our record label Greenway has never given us deadlines, which is really nice.
And what's the arrangement with a label today?
We still work with them. I think we got a few more albums to make for them, and we'd love to keep working with them. Harry from Greenway is like a good friend of ours at this point. Gives us complete freedom, and any suggestion he has, we're usually on board with. So it's an awesome relationship.
And where are they based?
Out of Brooklyn.
I mean, are they marketing the records? Are you guys responsible for that? They're doing it, and you guys are.
Yeah. Yeah. They're marketing it. They're working with, you know, press people. They really got their foot on the gas, which is great. They team up with a Levitation and Reverberation Appreciation Society out of Austin. So
I'm not familiar with, is that label serve like a label, or are they?
Yeah, it's a label that was kind of started by the Black Angels.
Okay.
Like 10 or 15 years ago. And since in the last few years, they've kind of started doing stuff again and teamed up with Greenway. So, yeah. Yeah, it's different for sure. I think with the things like the internet and streaming, for better or for worse, anyone can get out there or be noticed without the resources of a huge label or corporation.
Yep.
But things like, you know, touring and interviews or whatever still drive the machine.
Yep.
I don't think we'd get to the point we're at, wherever that is, if we hadn't been touring nonstop for the last 5 or 6 years. So it's slightly different. I think it's great that we don't have to rely on these huge labels where they sign you for one album. If it doesn't take off, they drop you. That just puts a lot of weird stress on the music industry, I think.
Creatively, it doesn't feel good to feel like you like to be scared and worried. You want to like have some freedom to feel like you can go create. I mean,
totally.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, again, common sense, I would imagine.
For sure. Yeah. That was our like mindset starting to work with Harry and Greenway. Cause at that point, I think it was 2018, we weren't really doing that much. They were just kind of a blip, and our decision was like, should we, you know, hold out for a bigger record label, or should we work with this team and try to grow together? And I think that's kind of has been what's happened. So,
yeah. Can we talk about just a couple songs on Data?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please.
I mean, what the first one that caught my eye, being a huge Miles Davis fan, was the term Mild Davis. Tell me about that tune. And I was curious, you know, I read that was sort of based around a particular Miles, 70s era Miles.
Yeah. Dylan and Nick, especially, were listening to a lot of that era, like electric Miles Davis. I think it might have been that like Jack Johnson record he did with him, not the pancake guy, but the other one. Yeah. And it was just that riff at first. It was that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's in a weird time signature. I think it's like 7/4. That was a cool one. I was down in San Diego, and those two were jamming and just sent me a voice memo of this. And I was just like, what is this? You know? And then we kind of fleshed it out, added, you know, Frankenstein, some other parts to it. And I think that was the first recording we had finished of the new record. So
interesting.
Yeah. It's called Mild Davis because of I just named it something stupid when we saved it one day, and it was really hard to call it anything else after that point.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was also interesting that, you know, all the, like the West African drumming and that idea. I mean, that was obviously a huge part of that Miles Davis era, but, you know, starting with Bitches Brew and sort of terminating with maybe like, you know, Live Evil, but that whole kind of chunk of Dark Magus and Agartha, yeah, and those kind of records were just full of that sort of that African drumming idea. And I will say that this is not like some big world music record that you guys made at all. But you do hear bits of that show up on some of these tunes, especially like Weird Dog, and you guys are blending a bunch of stuff into your own. It's like a real melting pot of your own into your own, you know, you're making sausage, you know.
Yeah, sure, a little kielbasa. Yeah, I think for the West African stuff, Pickle, our bass player, her parents, or her mom and stepdad, have taught a African drumming class for 10 years. So every time we're over there, we learn a new rhythm. It's a really nice exercise while we're on tour. We've all been listening to a lot of like Zam rock, or, you know, Nigerian rock, if you even want to call it rock, you know, Fela Kuti, all that stuff. And kind of that, I say that influences the instrumentation on stuff. the first instrument I ever played was alto sax. So those horn blasts are just me like making a little horn section with myself. That's pretty fun. But yeah, we don't go into it being like, let's make a Zamrock record, sure, or a Fela song. It's just kind of,
it's just there,
taking influence. Yeah, it's just there.
And yeah, I love the idea of like, you just, you know, you used to play sax, so you utilize that on these records. That does not change the, you know, it's just another texture and cool layer to this band, which I think, and I call it a dimension more than a layer or a texture.
Sure.
Yeah, it's another dimension to what you guys do, which I think is great, you know.
Yeah, thanks. You know, and I'm not good at sax, so it's never like, oh, Saturday Night Live. It's just like, it's textural.
Right.
It is. It's just another sound to utilize.
Well, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar with the King Giz stuff, but I saw them, like, I went and saw them play, and Stu just busts out the flute and just goes off. Like, he is actually really good at it. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling what those guys are doing.
And they're crazy talented.
It's not dissimilar to what you know, you're a different band, but those guys are just so, you know, pulling from so many different genres and just kind of filtering it out in their own way that it's pretty interesting. I think there's a lot of really interesting, cool music out there right now, you know, that's, like you said, being able to be found through the internet.
Yeah, and, you know, being self-recorded or independently released allows you to just do whatever.
Yeah.
I have mad respect for anyone that just, you know, takes risks like that, puts weird albums out, weird instruments on them.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Is a lot of the stuff that you guys end up being songs, do you guys get together and jam? Is that how you write?
Yeah. Well, we start every practice with a jam, and it's always rolling. We always have the session recording. So most of the songs, I'd say, start with a riff at least, or a chord progression. But that one literally just started with that drum beat. That's, you know, that came out really organically, more than any other song on that album, I'd say.
Nice. All right, cool, man. Well, thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at tapeop.com, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time.